Dude, if I were sitting there, it'd be dangerous. I just whisper a little bit.
Yeah, you just whisper a little bit, right. Good morning, Wednesday morning Bible study. We're continuing in our book, Ten Lies Satan Loves to Tell by Pastor Andrew Jones. This week we are doing lie number four. Life will be better if you seize more control. Before I get started, any lingering questions from last week or any thoughts before we get into it? Okay, let me start with the first 40 minutes or so, skim through the chapter, and then we'll look at the Bible verses and we'll have some discussion with the questions. So on page 72, by the way, I apologize slightly for my voice. I do have a little bit of a sore throat, so I don't know why. I'm hoping it's not turning into a cold, because I know there are some sicknesses going through the school, so I'm hitting vitamin C real hard right now. And warm coffee helps also. All right, so on page 72, at the top, if we need and deserve more, then we should take action and seize what we need and deserve. The central focus of this lie is our desire for power. Control and power, they kind of go together. That's the thrust of this particular temptation, this lie that Satan gives to us. Satan in the garden, he said, "For God knows that when you eat of it, your eyes will be opened and you will be like God, knowing good and evil." It is such a nefarious sentence because it is entirely true. Isn't it? Their eyes were opened and they knew good from evil. The problem is, the next paragraph, the unspoken implication is that this is good. Is it good to have your eyes opened and to know good and evil? No, that's not a good thing. You know, you sometimes say ignorance is bliss. I think not knowing the evil of the world is beneficial. Sometimes as we grow and we become more aware of how much evil and there's just some awful things that happen in the world, would we be better not knowing about that? Yeah, I think we would. That's how we will be when we get to heaven. We will not know about the evil that once existed here on earth. You'll know all the good. You'll have the peace and joy of heaven. And God will kind of just fade out the evil that we experienced or are aware of. That's a good thing.
Will you know who's in hell?
I think you might. Kind of like a fading memory. Like a foggy memory, you'll know who's in hell. It won't make you sad though. God promises that we'll have perfect joy and peace in heaven. So I think it's a case where if somebody's in hell, God will say, you know, you might think, well, where is so-and-so? Or where's my relative? Or, you know, my family member? Where are they? Oh yeah, they didn't believe in Jesus. They're in hell. And then you'll kind of go on with life in the bliss of heaven. So it'll just kind of be like a foggy, distant memory kind of thing. That's my interpretation, not official doctrine of our church. Okay? Don't turn me into that. So yes, I think we'll be aware, but it won't bother us because it'll just be kind of fuzzy. Okay? I think God will also open our minds to realize that it's just and right. Oh yeah, so-and-so, they rejected Jesus. They didn't believe in Jesus. Oh yeah, that's why they're missing from up here. Oh well, I'm going to go back to gardening. Okay, so that'll be part of it too. We'll understand the justice of God. Yes, it makes us sad right now, thinking there will be people that we know that aren't in heaven. That makes us sad. Now is the time to pray for them, to encourage them, to invite them, to teach them, all of that. All right, down at the bottom of page 72, there's that insert there. Satan encourages Eve to assert control over her situation, to be the master of her own destiny. That's part of what this lie is. Well, God is withholding from you the knowledge of good and evil, which is a good thing, by the way. But he's implying that, you know, you need to just reach out and grab a hold. You need to take control. Here's the lie. Now, a little side note, a slight bit of a field trip. I happen to think that this lie is particularly fruitful in American culture. because I think in our culture we have ingrained within us the mindset of I can do it myself, I'm in control, I want to be in control. Now here's my explanation of that. I made this last night as well. Through a big chunk of human history, going all the way back to Old Testament times and all the way up through the Middle Ages, even a little bit into modern times, one of the more predominant forms of government is monarchy. You're ruled by a king. And underneath that king, maybe there are princes or other minor nobility, right? Middle Ages, most of Europe, ruled by kings. Old Testament time, ruled by kings. Even today, there's a few kings around, or, you know, monarchies. Now, when you grow up under a monarchy, you realize that in your life and in your decisions with your family and your, you know, vocation, etc., you have a little bit of control. I can do this and that and the other thing. But ultimately, I'm under the authority of some nobleman, noble nobility, who's under the authority of the king. So you realize there are some things you can and cannot do. You have no control over. You grow up with that mindset. There's somebody over me who has that control. I only have this much control, not everything. America was founded on the idea of what? No king,
liberty.
No monarchy, liberty. And we as individuals, we can do what we want with our land, with our family, with our vocation. And as a group, we can decide what we want with our government and with laws. And so, you know, that mindset of, if you want something, go out and do it. Go out and get it. You can do it. You have complete control over everything in your life. That, I think, is a little bit more of an American mindset. Therefore, this lie is particularly fruitful, I think, by Satan against American Christians. Because we want control. That's my case. Any thoughts? A smidgen of discussion here? What do you guys think? Am I on the right track or not?
Yes.
Yeah.
Well,
I think
the idea of a king to start with, and all I can go back to is Israel, and they wanted a king.
Yeah, they wanted a king.
And so God gave them a king, but were there other kings around?
Yes. The nations around them all had kings.
That was something that man created themselves.
Yes, that was. Because God said, when the nation of Israel said, we want a king, God said, I am your leader. I'm your king. I will take care of you. I give you the laws. I will enforce them. No, we want an earthly king, somebody we can see. And they actually said this back in 1st and 2nd Samuel. They said, we want a king like the nations around us have kings. And they wanted a king who was strong and handsome and powerful and authoritative. So they wanted a king like that. And God said, well, I'll give you a king, but you won't like it. Yeah. John, did you have...
This whole topic is kind of shocking to me because, you know, you could look at it in terms of self-sufficiency, you know? Like, wow, he can do a lot of things, you know, he's very skilled, can handle things by himself, and if you take it one step further and you think about, like, the Amish, they're the epitome of, like, oh, we'll handle everything ourselves, you know?
Yeah.
And I never thought about it in those terms.
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure. Anyone else?
I think you really see that in the whole abortion debate because women want to say, my body, my choice. Mm-hmm. I'm in control.
Control, yeah.
Yeah. And it's been drilled into them from Planned Parenthood and whoever else that you have control.
Yeah.
You can make these...
So there's a modern day issue where this lie takes hold, that you have control, you can do what you want. Yeah, sure.
Whether it's right or wrong.
Yeah. Arlene and then Don.
Is it the same as a 2 or 3 year old that says, I want to do it myself?
Yes.
Is that kind of the same control starting there?
Yes, that control idea starts with toddlers, doesn't it?
Yeah.
I can do it myself. You don't help me. Yeah, right. Joan, kindergarten preschool teacher, do little kids act like that sometimes?
Oh, yeah.
Don?
When our country was founded, it was a case of, you know, the government is to protect us, otherwise leave us alone.
Yes, right.
And, you know, now it is, meddling is going on all over the place.
Yeah, well, see, that's part of my point, is that the American mindset is, leave me alone, I can do whatever I want myself, and I don't want your help. That's a control issue. I think that's part of our American mentality. Now, a little bit, that's good. You're going to see that. If you read the chapter, you know, he says sometimes that is necessary, but it is possible to go too far. Okay? So that's kind of where this ends up. And so the devil tries to push us. Actually, he says, it's coming up here in a couple of pages. He says the devil tries to push us to extremes rather than being in the middle to say, well, God gives you some control over your life, but not complete control. So we need to know there is that middle ground. All right, good. Good comments. Good comments. All right, page 73, right in the middle, Satan in the wilderness. So this is Satan with Jesus. And I think this is very insightful. It was informative to me. I had never heard this before. Satan seems to say, seize more control over your situation and all will be well. Show your power as the supposed Son of God. Later, he tempts Jesus to be hungry for power. So the bottom sentence there, the bottom paragraph there, Satan is playing chess with these temptations. In the first, Satan does not want Jesus to suffer the inconveniences of being human. And then you turn the page. Satan says, why not enjoy all the conveniences that power has to offer? Satan wants Jesus to forego any human limitation. Jesus, you're God. You can turn these stones into bread. You don't have to suffer human like the hunger like those humans do. Use your power to forego the human limitations that you're suffering. And then he says here, I cannot be sure, but it seems to me Satan is attempting to soften Jesus' resolve to prepare him to not endure other inconveniences. The last sentence then. If Jesus foregoes the inconvenience of hunger, perhaps he will forego the much larger inconvenience of death. I never thought about this before. Pastor Jones, you know, thank you, congrats. That's an insightful thing for me as a pastor. I'm like, so the temptation to turn stones into bread was not merely to stop your fast, to stop your time of prayer and fasting. Rather, it was a temptation to forego your humanness, to forego the inconvenience of being human. And if Satan can get Jesus to forego hunger, then that plants the seeds for Satan to tempt Jesus to forego death. And if Jesus would have skipped death, that would have been disastrous for all of us, right?
Right.
So right there, I'm like, wow, that's true, I think. So that wasn't a simple temptation that Satan was giving to Jesus. He was tempting Jesus for power. Use your divine power and control the situation. And then, kind of near the bottom of page 74, one of the other temptations we hear about from Satan, he says, you want these kingdoms? Go ahead. They are yours. No cross, no suffering, no struggle at all. Just worship me, and I'll hand them over. So Satan is right there. There's a half-truth that God has allowed Satan to have some measure of rule and control over the earth. Not complete. So Satan makes the implication that he owns the kingdoms. Well, that's only a half-truth. He does have some power and control over earthly matters, but not complete. God is still God. He's overseeing things. Think of Job. Satan had some measure of freedom to tempt Job, but not complete. But Satan is tempting Jesus to say, look at these earthly kingdoms. They are mine. I'll give them to you. You don't have to die. You don't have to go through that suffering on the cross. I'll give them to you. All you have to do is worship me, which then turns Satan into what? God. That was Satan's original sin. He wanted to be God, and that's why God kicked him out of heaven, right? Boy, that makes sense too. Wow. So Satan was having this lie that it's part of his temptations to Jesus about use your power, use your control. Satan's desired outcome, page 75. Satan seeks to seize control away from God And Satan wants us to follow him, to emulate him in the unquenchable quest for power and glory and control. Middle of the bottom paragraph, when we reject this lie, when we refuse to seize power, Satan tempts us toward the other extreme. Satan tries to get us to abdicate all our responsibilities. Satan does this by just showing us just how little power we have. He puts us in helpless situations, pulling us toward despair and meaninglessness. Either we emulate him as power-hungry tyrants, page 76 at the top, or we fall into despair over how little power we have. I think, again, that's very insightful. We want complete power and control over everything in our life. Oh, you can't have that? Well, then I just give up. Forget it. I don't care. And you just despair and you give up and just let somebody else do everything and I'm not doing nothing. I've had that attitude myself. Okay. What is the truth? The truth is in the middle. God gives you some measure of control over your life. You fulfill your vocation, you do your job, you're a parent, you're a husband, a wife, you're a son or a daughter, you do what you can in what little areas of control you have. And the bigger things, you leave them to God. But on the other hand, you don't despair and just give up and say, well, therefore I can't do anything. No, God gives you a smidgen of control, which is good, but not too much, so that you don't get into trouble. Okay? So you see, Pastor Jones is right here. Satan pushes us to the extremes, where we either want complete and total control, or we despair and give up on everything. The truth is in the middle. Okay? Does that sound right? I found that to be very helpful to myself, because I'm like, oh yeah, I felt like that before.
Sure.
Well, if I can't do what I want, well, then I'm just giving up. I'm not going to make a decision. Let somebody else figure it out. Well, that's not the right attitude either. All right? Comments or questions so far? We're at the end of a breaking point in the chapter. And you look like you want to say something, but you're not sure.
I'm not sure how to put it. Being in the middle is not easy.
Mm-mm.
It's just, we are giving something up.
Yes.
And we don't want to do that. And yet,
well,
if we're not in complete control and things are going awful, then we're in despair.
Let me give you real life example. And I have used this. I don't know if I have said this to you before or not. I might have. On the abortion issue. There are many Christians who say, well, we need to fight, we need to organize, we need to protest, we need to get into this fight and fight against abortion. It's murder. God says it's murder. It is a biblical issue, by the way. Not all issues are, okay? And I have said this to somebody. We can't control that issue in our government or in our culture. So you do what you can, and then you leave the rest to God. So you vote pro-life, I would say. That's within your control.
Absolutely.
Maybe you write a letter or you support pro-life organizations. And then the rest of the issues of that issue, the bigger issues, you leave it to God. It's out of our hands. So you do what little you can, what God does put in your control. You contribute, you vote, you support. And then on the bigger issue, did any of us have any impact on the Supreme Court's decision on pro-life matters? No, we didn't. That's beyond us. Now, the most recent issue about returning it to the states, that's good. I'm happy for that, but I have nothing to do with that. It's out of my control. So, while I applaud the decision, you're just like, okay, that's good. All I can do is my little piece. Right? That's what we do. That's true on all sorts of issues. The whole gender nonsense issue. Well, we should fight that. That's not true. That's there's 276 different genders. That's not right. No, it's not right. You're not going to fix it, nor am I. So, you make a statement, or you post a comment, or you support a group, and then you go on with life and let God take care of it. So you do what little you can, and then you let God take care of the rest. By the way, this also applies, I would say, to those family members who so many of you have talked to me, and I have some of my own, that have walked away from the church. Pastor, what do I do about my grandson or granddaughter? They don't come to church anymore. I wish they would. I said, you can't make them. So, you drop polite comments to them about inviting them to church, or grandma or grandpa would love to see you come to church with me on Christmas or Easter. You pray for them. That's within your control. And then you leave the rest up to God, because you can't do it. So there's that middle ground. You do what you can, encouraging them and praying for them, and then the rest is in God's hands. He's in control.
Yeah.
All of these issues, there are three issues I just brought up. There's the middle ground. You do what you can, and then you let God do it. He's God, not us. Sorry, I feel like I'm lecturing and sermonizing all at the same time. Did everybody write down? Anybody get that sermon down?
Well, going back to the abortion issue, there's some fracturing right now on the pro-life side, and because there's people out here on the extreme, you say we have to fight and this is wrong. One of the things that I saw posted recently is, well, women are murdering their babies, so they need to be punished.
Yeah.
It's not the way to take care of it.
Right.
So, you know, there to find that middle ground, even with such a volatile subject.
Yes.
So
a lot of these topics are very volatile. You're right. Yeah, Mary.
I did hear something on the news this morning that there is now a group of doctors who are saying that we should not do any of this transgender stuff on children.
Yeah. I saw that too. So it is, there is good news. There is movement in the right direction within our culture on the whole gender nonsense and transition, gender transit, trans, whatever they call it. So it's going in the right direction, but you and I don't control that.
No.
So while I applaud the decision and I'm glad that, or the trend, I'm glad for that. It's trending back. I don't do anything about it.
Also, somebody who detransitioned won several $1 million in a lawsuit.
Yeah, I saw that too. Yeah.
And
that's part of the movement of culture, is that some of the detransitioners, right. Mm-hmm. All right, let's go on. Oh, yeah, Bob?
Something I heard that the women's organization, like the League of Women's Voters and these ones that are really into being women, someplace along the line they started letting transgenders in there. And so there's a battle between the ladies that don't want the transgenders in there and the ladies who accept the transgenders.
Well, that's their fight, and that's too bad for them. That's some nonsense that shouldn't be happening.
Yeah.
Right. All right, the fear behind this lie. Let's go on. Page 76, the fear behind this lie. A combination of fears are at play with this lie. Sometimes we seize control because we fear being controlled by others. Do we fear being controlled by others? Absolutely. Do you want to be manipulated by somebody? No. I think that is that's an actual fear. Then he mentions another fear, the next paragraph. But we also may be driven to seize more control, but because it helps us with other lies. By having control, you can cover up your other sins and your other faults and your other lies. You can, by having control, you can prevent people from learning about your problems in life, your sinfulness in life, right?
Sure.
Bottom of page 76, here's the second reference by Pastor Jones that makes me really, really like him. Some of you see why.
Yes.
All these fears coalesce into a mess of restlessness and distrust that leaves us looking like Gollum from The Lord of the Rings. Hunched over, skittish, alone, clutching whatever power we have, and believing everyone we meet is trying to steal our power from us. How many of you are Lord of the Rings fans, or at least have seen the movies or read the book? maybe a quarter or a third of you, sort of. Yeah. All right, some of you know I'm a huge Lord of the Rings fan.
Oh, yeah.
I often, periodically, will sneak in a Lord of the Rings quote into a sermon without people knowing.
No.
Although Bob picks it up.
Yeah.
This is part of the reason why I like Pastor Jones, I think. Lord of the Rings right there. And he's absolutely right. This is a great illustration. The character Gollum in the books and in the movies is exactly this, power hungry. He wants the ring back, and he wants that power and control for himself. So this is a great illustration there. If you haven't seen the books, by the way, written by Tolkien, who was a Christian, so they do have a lot of Christian symbolism in them.
Is he the one that says, "My precious"?
Yes. Oh, Gollum is the one that says, "My precious."
My precious.
He wants the ring back because it's his precious. He wants control.
Yes.
Yeah. Exactly right. All right, page 77. The lie repeated in the Bible, the Tower of Babel. Tower of Babel. By the way, which is it? Babel or Babel?
Yes.
Sure. Bob's right. I looked it up in Hebrew once a while ago, and it can be either. There's no A there. So it's assumed, it's implied. It could be either a long A or a short A. So either pronunciation is correct. Babel or Babel?
Either or either.
Either or either.
Right. Yeah. Right.
Tomato, tomato. Right? Yeah. All right. So what's the issue with the people behind the Tower of Babel? Or should I say Babel, because they babbled in foreign languages. They wanted power.
Yeah,
he says it right in the middle of that first paragraph. These people want to leave a legacy. And then down right in the middle of the page, Satan is always trying to get us to attach our identity and unity to anything other than God. These people wanted power and control for themselves and to make a name for themselves, to make themselves glorious, right? Mm-hmm. Well, that was wrong. The very bottom of page 77, seeking to seize a better life, the people of Babel experienced one of the fruits of Satan's lies, division. All of Satan's lies cause division, do they not? Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Turn the page, 78. Abram, Sarai, and Hagar. I had forgotten about this. Abram is considered a righteous man. Throughout the Bible, he's called a righteous man because he believed in God, the true God, and followed God's direction. Here's an exception. What did Abram and Sarai try to do?
Play God themselves.
They wanted control. God promised them an heir, a descendant. They were both old. Well, God's not providing us a descendant. It was, 15 years after the promise that and Sarai was still not pregnant? We're not getting a descendant. We don't have a son or a daughter. We don't have anybody. We don't have an heir. So, Abram and Sarai conspire. Was Hagar part of that? Probably less so, but she must have at least been agreeable. So Sarai says, "Abram, why don't you have a child with my handmaiden, Hagar, and we'll call it our child and we'll be our descendant." And she does. It's Ishmael. And God says, no, that's not what I promised you. And I'm in control here. So even though you are 90 years old, you're going to have a baby. Imagine that.
Yeah.
I can't imagine that. Yes, they conspired to take control for themselves. See, even biblical characters that are described as being righteous and faithful, they still sin. That was a sin. Abram sinned. Moses sinned. Okay? David sinned. Peter sinned. All of them. Paul sinned. All right, the next example there, Herod's slaughter of the innocents. Was Herod after power and control? Oh, yeah. As soon as he heard from the wise men, the magi, that a new king had been born, he got green with jealousy and immediately started conspiring. He asked them, "What time did the star appear? And after you go visit, come back and tell me." Immediately. Mm-hmm. So right in the middle of page 79, the lust for power leads to a soul so disfigured it cannot recognize right from wrong, good from evil. Yeah. Very true. So it ends up back where we started in innocence, in the Garden of Eden, not knowing good from evil. But in this case, you end up not knowing right from wrong, confusing the two. Let me give you just a little side teaching here for a moment, because I remember hearing this and learning this somewhere along the line as a pastor. I think I might have read it somewhere. God gives you a conscience for your own benefit to help you resist temptation. Okay? So if you're about to do something bad, do you quite often realize, oh, this is bad, I shouldn't be doing this? Sometimes that stops you from whatever sin you're about to commit. Sometimes you ignore your conscience and sin anyway. Right? Yeah. Sound true? The problem with ignoring your conscience and going forward with a sin anyway, and this is quite common, I'll say, in somebody who's addicted. We'll say alcohol to start. It could be other addictions. There's so many of them. But you're addicted to alcohol. Bible says drunkenness is a sin, and you say, you know what? I know this is wrong, but I just can't help it. I need this drink, and you get drunk again. And if you ignore your conscience often enough, what ends up happening is you dull your conscience so you no longer recognize right from wrong. I have had this conversation with somebody, not recently, a while ago, about, well, I know I'm addicted, but if I commit this sin over and over again, God will keep forgiving me. And I say, well, yes, actually he will. You keep asking him forgiveness, he will keep forgiving you, even though you commit this sin over and over because you're addicted. The problem is, the more you commit this sin and indulge in it, rather than fighting it, you dull your conscience to the point where you no longer think it's a sin. And then what happens? You don't ask for forgiveness. And therefore, you're not forgiven. And you've just lost salvation. You're not forgiven. So, going against your conscience is dangerous, because if you do it often enough, you dull your conscience to the point of being like Herod, where you don't know the difference from right and wrong, and you no longer think of sin as a sin. Does that make sense?
Oh, yes.
So that's why, and I teach in Bible study and confirmation and all the rest, God gives you a conscience, at least at the beginning of your life, and for all of you here, a conscience that still holds true to the truth of what's right and wrong. Obey your conscience. If you disobey or ignore your conscience for long enough, you'll dull your conscience and it will no longer be helpful to resist temptation. Mm-hmm. Okay?
That is true.
Thoughts or comments?
Well, I can remember that. I can remember in parochial school and also in confirmation instruction, the teacher and the pastor both explained that very carefully.
Okay, so you've heard that before.
And made a big point of that, warning us against going...
against your conscience.
Against
your
conscience.
Good.
I have another question.
Okay, question.
On page 78,
The
middle of the page, he says here that Hagar has no say in being given to Abraham. I wonder...
I don't know. Maybe that's true. Hagar being a good handmaiden to Sarai, did she just do what Sarai told her? Or did she have some say? Could she have said no? I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know.
I don't know what
either,
the culture and relationship was there.
But that's what he says.
That's what he says, yes. Maybe that's true.
Well, that's his opinion anyway.
Yeah, Bob.
This plays back to Satan with our conscience. He says, you deserve to have that candy bar. You deserve to have that beer. You worked hard today.
Yeah.
And that destroys your conscience.
Yes. That's exactly right. Yeah, Dan, you had your hand up?
Yeah, the whole area of conscience, because there are some, and Herod was a good example, and I can remember a student that it was never wrong, you know, and from a young age, perhaps, had very little conscience.
Yeah.
And you see other criminal types, mm-hmm. you know, that basically have killed.
Yeah.
What may have been there. On the other hand, just a program we watched last night about the Turpin kids, you know, being raised in terrible circumstances and yet overcoming it.
Yeah.
You know, so.
And when you see like murder mysteries, or you hear on the news about mass murders or serial murders, and you say, how can they do that? Doesn't their conscience bother them? Maybe the first one or two, but they ignored their conscience enough that it's dulled and they become, I guess, a psychopath, where they commit crimes without feeling guilty about it. And that comes from ignoring your conscience for too long. Yeah. Yep. Right. All right, the lie repeated in our world, bottom of page 79. I just looked at my watch. We're behind schedule.
Oh, my.
Can we go 5 or 10 minutes over? Good conversation, though. See, here's another support as to why I like Pastor Jones. Using our power and control is something we do automatically, and sometimes this is necessary and warranted. When we are hungry, we find something to eat. You have control over that. When we are tired, we try to get some rest or find a cup of coffee. You have some control over that. When we want to see New Zealand, we make plans to visit. Now, why does he use that as an example, going to New Zealand?
Lord of the Rings.
That's where Lord of the Rings is found.
Oh, okay. Yes. I wonder why.
That's an odd example for him to put in here, isn't it? I will tell you. Jill and I are both Lord of the Rings fans. We've seen the movies probably a dozen times at this point. We freely quote them to each other, and I occasionally stick a quote in a sermon. We want to go to New Zealand. There actually are travel trips where you can go and see where Lord of the Rings was filmed. And you want to go too?
Well, she lived there.
Oh, you did?
I lived for 2 years.
Oh, that's right. That's right. I forgot that.
And they have there the Hobbit city.
Yeah, the Hobbit village, right. Yeah. We would love to see Hobbiton. And you can see the scenery and say, oh, yeah, there's the mountains as they are in the movie, and I recognize it. Yes, I would love to go there.
Bilbo Baggins.
Bilbo, yes, right. So anyway, that's why. But back to the topic, though. He's right. We do have some control over some things. See, this is that middle ground area, right? Mm-hmm. We do have control over bits. Okay, page 80, right in the middle. Any example of genocide comes from people believing this lie. The political world is filled with fights over power. Really? You guys think that? Politics is all about power?
No.
Yeah, it certainly is. And then right at the bottom of page 80, near the bottom, five lines up, the ends justifies the means, Satan says.
Yeah.
You guys have heard that before, right?
Yeah.
That, as Christians, we would say that is absolutely false. The ends does not justify the means. Mm-hmm. So the point of that saying, a philosophical saying, which Satan includes with this lie, is that, well, if the end is some good or some charitable good, and you achieve that result through some unethical or unscriptural, unchristian means, that's okay, because the end is good. That's like telling a mobster it's okay to extort and run drugs as long as you donate money to a charity at the end. No, just because you do something good at the end doesn't justify unethical and un-Christian behavior to get there. So as Christians, yes, we want to do charitable things and good works, but we want to get there by doing the right thing along the way. So we would say, no, the ends does not justify the means. So there's just a little side note again. If you ever hear that comment, that line, which you do sometimes out in the world, or in movies, or in society, well, the ends justifies the means. No, we disagree with that, we as Christians. Okay?
Maybe the
John?
It's kind of strange. I think about it like Al Capone. And he was really noted for being such a generous, fatherly figure. And all
right.
That
oh, yeah.
And yet he got all of that ability through very scandalous means, through criminal means,
Right.
Yeah, Dan.
Maybe there's one exception to that.
Yeah?
The end justified the means of Jesus suffering and death.
But how? What was the means of Jesus getting there? He didn't do anything unethical.
No.
Or ungodly.
But everything, yeah.
he did everything properly and the way it was intended, and he still had bad ends. But he also had the proper means as getting there, yeah. But you're right, that's maybe an example that we could ponder on that. Top of page 81. I think we all fall into this lie. Here he gives us an example. We all fall into this lie. Well, I would have written a better ending to that book. It was a terrible ending. I would have installed the TV perfectly centered and level rather than those workmen who did that. And look, it's crooked or it's not centered. I would have done it better. Well, I would have caught that touchdown pass. Yeah, I think that. How could that guy have dropped that? If me, even at my age, I could have caught that pass. Why did he drop that? It cost our team the game. We think that. I think that. I would never have dried out the chicken if I were the one cooking. So, we all think a little bit of this lie. In those areas, those are perfect examples of how this lie comes home to each one of us, because we often think, well, I would have done it better. Yeah, Fred?
I keep thinking about the word superstition.
Yeah?
And that's a seed to this lie, because everything's got to be just set up just right for my team to win the game. You know, I've got to have crackers here and whatever there. And
the right jersey on and the right hat. Drink,
yeah. The right clothes on, and that's how they won last time. I've got to have it set.
Yeah.
And you feel like you're in control of helping them.
Yeah. True superstitions. Yeah. Yeah, I agree.
You feel that you have that control.
Yeah. That's right.
And you do that with so many things.
Yeah, that is part of superstition, is trying to have control. I think you're right. Good, that's good insight.
Sure.
All right. Page 81, two-thirds of the way down. Some of us do not have to imagine these things because they have happened to us. Control was seized, and the fruit of such actions is often anger, pain, division, and, if Satan can manage it, hatred. So that's what Satan is after when he does this. Then the very bottom of page 81, yet the place where Christians find themselves most obviously struggling with this lie, especially in the United States, see, he agrees too, this lie is prevalent here, is the realm of culture wars. Do we engage in culture wars? Actually, last night, as an example, and we've already discussed it, I brought up the abortion issue here. Because some Christians, you know, we gotta organize for a fight. We need to fight this issue. And we need to change things, and we need to win and battle the culture on the whole pro-life issue. My attitude is, you know, yes, that, by the way, happens to be a scriptural issue. It's in the Bible, okay. But you can't control it. And by trying to engage in a culture war, you're going to drive yourself nuts. And you're going to try and do something beyond what you have the power or control to do. So, I've already mentioned, on this and so many other culture war issues, we've already mentioned three of them earlier. I brought those examples up maybe too early, because it goes right here. You do what you can. You voice your support. You vote the way you can. You maybe, support a given issue. And then you leave it go and let God take care of it. It's all up to God. We can't change the culture just like that. And no amount of fighting is going to do that on any one individual part of us, other than it's going to drive you crazy. So, you do what little you can, and then you go on with life and let God take care of it. That's my attitude on these culture war issues. Okay? Yeah, Dan?
Maybe the other thing is, it becomes like in Michigan, of course, we lost the fight against Proposition 3.
We did?
Which was, you know, tragic. In that sense, but it's the individual. Mm-hmm. So Life Plan, for example, lives to serve the individual.
Yeah, right. Culture. That's something we control. You help individuals who are struggling with this issue. Yeah, right, exactly. Yeah, all the way back there, Sharon.
God can use evil for good.
He can use evil for good. That's exactly right. Maybe that whole Prop 3 thing from a few years ago, there's some good that has come out of it. Yeah, right. Yeah, Jeannie.
I'm glad you said that. You let it go. My neighbor is into politics not going her way, and I can see how it's just tearing her up.
Yeah.
And I feel like, well, gee, if she's doing that, maybe I'm not doing enough.
Yeah.
But I'm more like, you gotta pray about it. Otherwise, it's
yeah. Pray about it. You can vote the way you want, and then ignore it.
Yeah.
Because it'll just chew you up. Absolutely. No matter how you feel on a given political topic, yes, or culture topic, right? Let God take care of it. It's His job, not ours. All right, page 82. Right in the middle, right below that inset, it is as if people believe the future of the church hinges upon having ample power and control to pass on to the next generation. Does the church's existence depend upon us? Not in the least. We think we, the church, need to have power and control in order to sustain the church into the future. That is a lie. The church has nothing to do with us. Is Christianity declining in America? Yes. What happens when Christianity declines? Actually, it gets stronger. You look at the early church. You look at the church in China. It's underground. And yet it is strong. Could God actually be allowing us, the church, to be experiencing increased persecution here in America in order to strengthen us?
Oh, yeah.
This lie that we need to have power and control in order to preserve the church and help the church sustain itself and grow, that's a lie. It has nothing to do with us. And God might actually say, I'm going to let you be persecuted in order to strengthen you. Somebody last night asked about, and I'll bring this up at the end again, but somebody last night asked about, well, what about the Bible? Is God's Word going to survive? Don't we need to help preserve that? And I say, no. You know, if there's, the Bible is so prevalent, and there's so many copies of it, so many places, including in the original Greek and Hebrew, Satan could do his best to burn books and ban books. They tried doing that in China and in Russia. And they burned all the Bibles, and guess what? There's still Bibles there. God preserves it.
Sure.
It's not up to us. We aren't in control. God will preserve the church. God will preserve His Word. Okay? And I like how he says this right here. So here's some wonderful... This right near the bottom of page 82. I feel like this is a little mini-sermon from Pastor Jones. And well done, Pastor Jones. I don't even know him, but well done. He says this, dear reader, the future of the church depends on the power and control of only one person, Jesus. Jesus is the past, present, and future of the church. Jesus' authority is the only authority that matters to the church. We are called to follow Him. This need and lust for power and influence over the culture is idolatry. It is not the way of Jesus. Culture wars spur from Satan's lie that you need to seize more power and control. Wow, that's true. Look to Jesus, cling to Jesus, let Him take care of things. It's not up to us. He's the one in control. All right, all the way up to the middle of page 83, the truth. Any comments so far on that part? Yeah, Ellen.
You know, I've heard people say, I don't care. They don't understand that the devil isn't out there to get you on his side. He's out there to destroy you.
Yeah, right. It's a misunderstanding. Totally. Exactly right. Yeah. All right, page 83. I got to speed this up a little bit. We still got about 5 or 6 pages. Sorry. The truth is that Jesus calls us quite plainly and obviously to suffer being wronged by those in power. Oh, do we want to hear that? Those who abuse their power over you. What are we to do as Christians? Suffer. Tolerate. That's it. Jesus says, and then he goes on to say, you know, if somebody... hits you on one cheek, you turn the other cheek. If they make you walk a mile carrying their stuff, you go 2 miles. We are to suffer those who abuse their power. But what do we want to do? We want to get back. We want to control. We want control for ourselves in order to get justice against those who have abused their control and power. Bottom of page 83, Jesus calls us to a humility and a humbleness that looks weak and meek to the world. Did Jesus look weak and meek to the world? Absolutely. There were a couple of times that he asserted himself, like the money changers in the temple, or scolding the Pharisees. But the vast majority of the time, Jesus tolerated. He let the persecution happen. And it made him look weak to the eyes of the world, but to us we know it wasn't. That's what we're called to do as well. All right, page 84, right in the middle, God's desired outcome. God's desired outcome is that we become more and more like Jesus. God's desire is that we become more humble, gentle, and weak, meek. Yeah, that's not something we like. We want to, I'm going to speak a little bit for my gender, especially men. We want to be, okay, we're in authority, we're in control. No, we are to tolerate, we are to be, allow ourselves to suffer, we are to not fight back. How hard is it to not fight back? I think that's hard. Top of page 85. What is Jesus' character? It is typified by gentleness, humbleness, and meekness. Yeah. And then again, another insight. I put a little star next to it, right in the middle of page 85. Jesus humbled himself very obviously in two very important ways. So right there in the middle of the page, he chose to empty himself when he became a human being. He became entirely dependent. Jesus is God. He's in control of everything. He was there at creation. And what did he do when he became a baby? What does a baby do for itself?
Nothing.
Absolutely nothing. A baby is 100% dependent. Jesus gave up his divine power and became a baby. That's incredible right there. What's the second way Jesus relinquished power and control, gave up power and control? The next one. Then Jesus emptied himself of all this power even further by dying. He even said, I can call 12 legions of angels, but I'm not going to. He just let it happen to him. He was falsely accused and put on trial and beaten and flogged and tortured and crucified, and he just let it happen. He tolerated it. Why? For you. For you and me. That's incredible. Okay, turn the page. The love that casts out fear. Page 86. We are afraid of being vulnerable. I think that's true. We are afraid of being vulnerable, he says. But then right there, halfway down, Peter writes, humble yourselves, therefore, under the mighty hand of God, so that at the proper time he may exalt you, casting all your anxieties on him, because he cares for you. So when you have a smidgen of control, you use your control for whatever little bit you can. But otherwise, you let God take care of it. He cares for you. So he will do what is necessary and in your best interest. Cast your anxieties on him. What a great Bible verse. 1 Peter chapter 5, verse 7. Okay? That kind of brings us to the end of the chapter for my highlights. I know you guys have had lots of contributions and comments along the way. Any final ones before? I'll try and wrap up the questions in Scripture in 5 minutes. Yes, you can laugh here. I'll try to make it 5 minutes. It might not be. Yes, right. All right, so page 89. Let's look at the Bible passages real quick. We'll do that first. So Psalm 46. This is a great one. So here it is. I got it on the screen. It's like 11 verses, I think, so I'll read through it fairly quickly. God is our refuge and strength, the very present help in trouble. Therefore we will not fear, though the earth give way, though the mountains be moved into the heart of the sea, though its waters roar and foam, though the mountains tremble at its swelling. There is a river whose streams make glad the city of God, the holy habitation of the Most High. God is in the midst of her. She shall not be moved. God will help her when morning dawns. The nations rage, the kingdoms totter. He utters his voice, the earth melts. The Lord of hosts is with us. The God of Jacob is our fortress. Come, behold the works of the Lord, how he brought desolations on the earth. He makes wars cease to the ends of the earth. He breaks the bow and shatters the spear. He burns the chariots with fire. Be still. And know that I am God. I will be exalted among the nations. I will be exalted in the earth. The Lord of hosts is with us. The God of Jacob is our fortress. The whole point of this psalm is that the nations rage, There's turmoil on earth. There's problems all around us. God is in control. He can make wars to cease. He can break the bow and shatter the spear. God is in control, so just be still. Let God be God. Be still and know that He is God. He will take care of you. He's ultimately in control. I like this psalm. By the way, do you know this psalm is the inspiration for Martin Luther's great hymn, A Mighty Fortress Is Our God?
Oh, yeah.
The Lord of Hosts is with us. The God of Jacob is our fortress. That's the word right there, inspired Martin Luther. Have any of you ever been in a castle? Some of you? I see a few hands. Yeah?
Yeah, maybe.
I understand that, like, the great giant castles of medieval times, very few of them were ever conquered. If you just kind of think about history and wars. If they had enough food and water stores inside, they could withstand an awful lot and a long siege as well. That's what God is for you. You are in the fortress of God. He will take care of you, and He will protect you from all the nonsense that's happening out there, including the devil, including the world, including the culture wars, all the rest of it. Okay? And there is a river that makes glad the city of God, right here, verse 4. There's a river whose streams make glad the city of God. What is the city of God?
Heaven.
Ultimately, heaven. And very literally, at a certain point in time, it was Jerusalem. But then, in Revelation, it talks about New Jerusalem, which is a reference to heaven. So, the city of God is heaven. What river makes glad the city of God? What river is that?
The river of life, right? Is that what it is?
Well, that's part of it, the river of life. But I think there's a more obvious, but, well, maybe hidden implication here. The river of blood and water that flowed from Jesus' side when he was pierced. What does that river bring? That river brings forgiveness. Blood and water. The Lord's Supper and baptism. Mm-hmm. Jesus' death. That brings forgiveness. And because of that forgiveness, you are in the city of God. You have a foretaste of the city of God, and you will be in the city of God one day when he calls you home. That river makes us glad. In the midst of all of these things, the nations rage, the kingdoms totter, yes, we can be at peace. Be still and know that I am God. Yeah.
There is a river mentioned in Revelation, isn't there?
Yeah, the river of life.
River, okay.
Yeah, so that's part of an implication here too.
Okay.
Sure.
Okay.
Now, if you look at your book, 2 Samuel chapter 11 through chapter 12, that's almost two entire chapters. That's the story of David and Bathsheba and Nathan, Prophet Nathan. Did David try to seize control?
Oh, yes.
David committed the initial sin of adultery. And then he followed this particular lie and tried to control the situation for what purpose? To hide his previous sin. That's a case of an example for us. And Nathan eventually calls him on it and says, not only did you commit that sin, you committed that sin, that sin, that sin, that sin, and that sin. And David is crushed in repentance, appropriately so. So that's a good tale for us, a good event for us as an example. And John chapter 13. That's Jesus washing feet. Jesus is giving them an example. We are to serve one another. I am serving you. You go out and serve others. And what does Peter try to do? Seize control. Peter says, no, Jesus, you don't wash my feet. I'm going to wash yours. And Jesus says, you don't understand, Peter. Sit down and let me wash your feet. And then Peter says what? Well, then not my feet, my whole body. So Peter's trying to control the whole situation. Peter, stop being such a loudmouth. Just shut up and let Jesus teach you. Right? Peter wants control. Yeah, Bob.
It's like John went in the baptism. Jesus says, let it be so for now.
Yes. There's another example. John the Baptist says, no, I need to be baptized by you. And Jesus says, no. that you baptize me. Let it be so for now, for righteousness' sake. Yeah, you're right. That's a great example. Okay, let me zip through these questions real quick, just a couple minutes. Where do you see this lie appearing in your life? Give me one or two examples. I have answers here that I wrote for myself, okay? But I tell my confirmands, I'm not giving you the answer until at least one of you gives me an answer. So, where do you see this lie appearing in your life? One or two thoughts. Don, are you trying to raise your hand?
I'm going to say the government.
Government? Okay. All right. We want control over the government, or we want the government to do what we want them to do. Sure. I don't think that speed limit sign is right. It should be 45, not 35. Actually, that happened to me.
Uh-oh. Uh-oh.
What did they say?
Well, I was heading from Meyer downtown Stevensville. And then I was going to turn left and head that way.
Yeah.
And a cop pulled me over. And I think at the time, it was 25. And I think I was probably doing 40.
Oops.
And I just was polite and, you know, I'm sorry, officer, I didn't realize. I thought, you know, this is, he said, I know, it's a main street. He let me go with a warning.
Yay.
And then I noticed about 6 months later, the speed limit was changed.
To 35.
It's 35 now, right?
Yeah.
And I'm like, well, thank goodness. So maybe other people complained enough or somebody.
No,
but
probably.
There was a lawsuit, someone that had sped down John Beers. Yeah.
Whoa.
So and there was a lawsuit, the speed limit got changed?
Well, yeah. The person who had sped, was speeding, the lawyer argued that the speed limit wasn't correct.
Yeah.
And so.
Well, I would have agreed with that at that moment.
But yeah, it was changed because of that.
So there's an example of how we see this lie appearing in our life. We want to control things, right? Any other thoughts? I'll try and wrap this up quickly. In what situations have you been most tempted to seize control?
In your house.
In your house, yes, right. Is there a fight over the remote control in your house?
No.
No?
No, because I'm the boss.
Oh! See, in the when it comes to a fight, and so I say this a little bit tongue in cheek in our house, the remote control, Jill just gives it to me. She says, "You have the remote control," because she's always crocheting and she needs both hands.
Oh!
But then she tells me what to do with the remote control. So who's really in control?
That's right.
So is a little bit of a funny tongue-in-cheek kind of thing, but there is a little battle of control over what we want to watch. Somebody last night said, well, we have two remotes in our house. And I said, what if you're both trying to change it to a different channel exactly simultaneously? He said, yeah, that happens. That's a problem. All right. Yeah, in our home, I put down, in what situation are you most tempted to seize control? When you feel like you've been manipulated or taken advantage of. I want to seize control back for myself, because somebody else took advantage of me. Can you remember a time when you were afraid of being manipulated? What was that like? I got to guess, all of us, if you think, there's been a time in your life, either way in the past or more recently, where you felt like you were manipulated by somebody. What kind of emotions do you have when that happens? Angry, I heard. What else?
Frustration.
Fear.
Frustration. Fear.
Fear.
Uneasy.
Uneasy. Yeah.
Disappointment.
Disappointment that somebody would do that to you. Yeah. I put down scary. I don't know what's going to happen. Somebody else is in control, trying to manipulate me.
Pastor?
Yeah.
The time I see power control taking its ugly head is at when a family member dies.
Mm-hmm.
How do you disperse?
You're exactly right. That does happen a lot.
All the time.
When grandparents or parents die, and then the kids are like, well, no, I want that. Well, who's going to be in control? Who's going to do this? Well, yes, you're right. That's a prime example in modern life. Yeah. Okay, this next question, he's been asking this question, we already know the answer. Who can you trust to tell you the truth when you are struggling with this lie? Well, hopefully, a faithful spouse, a good Christian friend, or your pastor. So there's three answers, okay? I think that's the same as it's been for each of these chapters. Okay, then the last question, then we'll sum it up. Can you think of other biblical characters who unhelpfully seized for examples for us to ponder? Yeah, who?
King Ahab. When he wanted the vineyard of Naboth,
and
remember, and he was all upset.
Yes.
And then his wife said, "Don't worry, I'll get it for you."
Yes.
And
he
wanted it no matter what.
Yeah, that's true. What else?
Moses and the rock.
Moses and the rock. God said, "Speak to the rock." Moses wanted the glory; he wanted control. So he struck the rock, and God said, That's a good one, yes. Bob.
King Saul, when he gave a sacrifice before Samuel.
Oh, yes, King Saul. Samuel said, "Wait for me, and we'll give a sacrifice and worship God." And he said, "No, I'm doing it myself." You're right. That's an obscure example, but a good one, yes. Yeah, Linda. Peter in the garden. Yes, with the ear. Oh, that's a good one, too, yes. Peter's like, "No, they're not going to arrest Jesus." Out comes the sword, right? And Jesus says, "What are you doing? Put that away. You're not going to control this situation." And he heals Malchus's ear, right? The servant's ear. Yeah, Ellen. Oh, yeah, all right. There you go. They're misrepresenting their offering, right? We just heard about that back in Acts which we finished. Yes, so there's another attempt to seize control. Does it always end badly? Yeah. We need to beware of trying to seize control away from God. Okay? All right. Sorry, we're 15 minutes over. Almost 20 minutes over. 17 minutes over. Final question or comment? All right. You may remain seated, but if you can, please rise. We'll close with the Lord's Prayer. Sorry that we went over. Our Father,
who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, and the power, and the glory, forever and ever.
Amen. Thanks for coming. Have a good day. And if I can just have your attention just for another moment.